So it is with tremendous pleasure that I'm going to go through Diane's bio, which is just tops of the daisies of her accomplishments, but it's important that you understand what a treasure we're about to have. Diane's globally recognized for 45 years of clinical work, specifically with trauma victims. She's trained caregivers on 6 different continents in responding to trauma and to the abuses of power. And she's spoken in several of our sessions about power, which has been very helpful to us. She directs her own counseling practice that's located in Pennsylvania. And she includes 15 therapists with multiple specialties. Among her books, so these will all be on your list, Counsel for Pastors' Wives, Counseling Survivors of Sexual Abuse, On the Threshold of Hope, which also comes with a workbook, In Our Lives First, Meditations for Counselors, and Suffering in the Heart of God, How Trauma Destroys and Christ Restores. Dr. Langberg is the co-leader of the Global Trauma Recovery Institute housed at Biblical Theological Seminary. She's former chair of the executive board of the American Association of Christian Counselors, and she's on the board of GRACE, which is Godly Response to Abuse in a Christian Environment. She serves as co-chair for the American Bible Society's Trauma Advisory Council. Dr. Langberg is the recipient of the Distinguished Alumna Achievement from Taylor University and American Association of Christian Counselors Caregiver Award, the Distinguished President's Award, and the Philadelphia Council of Clergy Christian Service Award. She's married and she has 2 sons and 4 grandchildren. I first met Diane because I read Counseling of Survivors of Sexual Abuse, and it so addressed all of the things that I didn't understand, that I was faced with, that I was confounded by, that I was so enthused by somebody who was helping me that I just picked up the phone and said, I have to meet you. Slight stalker quality. And so because she's just in Pennsylvania, I made appointment time with her, and I went up and I spent some very, very rich time with her. And she was, as you will see, endlessly gracious. And since then, she has been absolutely instrumental to the Samaritan Women and to me personally. She has been a resource for me when I'm so at my wit's end and hitting a wall. She has been incredibly helpful to our organization, advising us when we are in a client situation that has just confounded us. She has introduced us to a wealth of people who help us in other areas. She just has that kind of giving heart, and she has so much knowledge to share that I am going to invite you to give your undivided attention to Diane Langberg.
I needed PR, I'd hire Jean. I was asked to say something about resources for secondary trauma before I start, and so I'm going to make it quick and easy. Heather Evans, who's sitting back there on the side, is a friend and colleague, did the talk on secondary trauma today. And so when you go on the web and all these things are up there, she has a list of resources of books that you can use for that area of great need, I am sure. First of all, it is an honor and privilege for me to be here. You'll hear a little bit about my story as a clinician today, but I basically watched this movement happen because I'm old, and worked with victims of trafficking long before that was a word. So to see this, and to hear about your various work and your care for these women has been a real blessing to me. So God bless what you do. You are involved in the work of rescue and rehabilitation and restoration. Women land on your doorstep through various means, I'm quite sure. But whatever else is true about them, what you do know is that they have been trafficked, most of them. That means in part that they are human beings who have been illegally bought and sold as objects to be used and exploited by the buyer owner, much as you or I might go to the store and purchase an item that we want. She is likely devoid of a sense of self, a sense of value, a sense of choice, and I suspect she sees you as simply the next person who will use her in some way. Given what we know from the bits of research that have been done in recent years, the odds are ridiculously high that she carries a long trauma history of sexual abuse, violence, addictions, and no safe place ever. If what you do is to be actually helpful and effective, then that means you must come to understand how she thinks, how she feels, and how she relates to other humans. Otherwise, you will misinterpret her, and you can be sure she will misinterpret you. For those of you who do not know, I'm a psychologist who spent 4+ decades working with trauma. I started out 9 years before post-traumatic stress disorder was even a diagnosis on the books. So nobody talked about trauma back then. It wasn't a word. I saw my first trafficking victim 40 years ago. Though I certainly did not know it was called that, and neither did she. I have worked with victims of sexual violence, domestic violence, trafficking, torture, and genocide. I have learned, because my patients had the courage to tell me their hidden stories, and the patients to help me learn. It was a relationship of mutual studenthood. Some years ago, I audited a course online with Dr. Donna Hughes. I'm sure most, if not all of you, are familiar with her at the University of Rhode Island. And it was on trafficking, and I learned a great deal from that course. But at the end of the course, she wrote me and said, basically, teach those who are working with victims about trauma. We both agreed that it was the missing piece. I think early on it was thought that if you rescue, rehab, and teach a skill, then everything will turn out okay. Didn't turn out to be so. And that's because of the significant traumas involved in trafficking itself were not actually understood at that time, let alone the long histories of trauma that many of these women have had. And so what was happening in the industry, so to speak, in the work, was very similar to what happens with prison programs or even post-prison programs. You start out with really good intentions and a heart full of love and wanting to help and a revolving door. So today what I want is to take you with me into the presence of long-standing and very complex trauma. It is not an easy journey. One of the things that I repeatedly have to teach to young therapists is that when a trauma victim uses a word that we all use to describe things in our lives or about our internal states, she does not mean what we mean. Words like afraid or sad or overwhelmed are all words that we use. But when we hear another person use them, we assume that we understand. When there has been significant trauma, we do not understand. And even if we have had trauma in our own lives, there is a uniqueness to every single experience. So keep it in mind as we look in trauma. And later on in the presentation, I want to show you some things to help you grasp experientially what I'm talking about. Historically, when somebody has endured a traumatic event, they have often been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. But in recent years, our understanding of trauma has grown so that we've come to realize there's got to be a different diagnosis for a certain subpopulation under the larger heading of trauma. Complex psychological trauma, which is what it's being called now, involves stressors that are repetitive and chronic. They involve direct harm or neglect by those who should have been caregivers. They often occur at developmentally vulnerable times and have the potential to severely compromise human development. Post-traumatic stress disorder is not a significant diagnosis for human beings literally marinated in abuse and terror over an extended period of time. Complex trauma involves interpersonal violence that is, again, usually repeated over time. It involves profound betrayal, deception, and coercion. It includes child abuse of any kind. It can also include people who have what I call layers of trauma. So you might have somebody who grew up physically battered in a home, was raped as a teenager, and then trafficked, say, from 18 to 30. So it's not all the same trauma or the same people, but it's layers of it. Most trafficking victims have spent years in what I call domestic war zones. They have been saturated in unpredictability, violence, loss, rape, fear, betrayal, lies, captivity. This is before many of them ever enter the trafficking world. That means that how their brain works, how their body works, how they understand the self, how thoughts are organized, how they label the world, how they name and regulate emotions, how relationships are understood and conducted, all have deep roots in the life-destroying acid of trauma. So, think with me about a case. A little girl born into a violent home, and she was supposed to be a boy. The first incident in her life when she is brought home from the hospital is to have cigarettes put out on the bottom of her feet because she had the audacity to arrive as a female. She goes on from there to be raped by her father, brothers, males in the extended family, and others, sometimes chained to a radiator to eat like a dog because they said she wasn't human, later finding food in trash bins, and eventually trafficked by her father across state lines by the time she was 12 years old. This woman is a human being. She was created by God in his image. She was knit together in the womb by God. It was the last safe place she ever knew. She has known constant distress. She doesn't know about escape. It's hardly an escape to be out on the streets eating from trash bins. Gross insecurity, negligence, instability, pain, humiliation, you name it. She has never once in her lifetime known the experience of pain inflicted, followed by safety and comfort. Now you think about a little kid running down the driveway, he falls and skins his knee, and he runs back to mommy, and what does he get? Safety and comfort. That pairing happens early on in our lives. She has never experienced that pairing. There are some, of course, who grow up in similar ways who do get some of their wounds tended, but the only reason they're tended is so that others can't see them. So for many trafficking victims, trauma is not a terrifying event followed by care. It is an utterly, relentlessly terrifying life. If there is respite, it comes in the form of alcohol, drugs, dissociation, self-injury, or death. Those are the exit doors. As a result of this chronic interpersonal trauma, the individual develops constant vigilance, always anticipating danger, chronic anxiety, and terror. She is never at ease. All of her psychological energy is bent by necessity toward coping, surviving, not toward learning or growing. So rather than as a child learning, imagining, experimenting, and growing, she is instead learning to fear, to hide, and to self-protect. She's been betrayed by those who should have been caring and nurturing, and she cannot find or seek out comfort and assistance. I want to read you two poems written by somebody who grew up in chronic trauma, just to get a feel for her voice and how she describes this. I am shackled to you. I cannot get away. Must do everything with you. You never die. You do not sleep. I wake and you are there, waiting. I go to sleep and you catch up, hunting me like a rabid fox. Like a clock secondhand, tick, 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 predictable in your presence, you do not tire. You do change the date and time on me at will. Your name, trauma. Here's one more. I smell an odor about me that cannot be washed away. It is on my hair and my skin. It comes from inside. Sometimes, if the wind changes or ceases to let itself be known, or I mask with a scent that is clearly not my own, I can conceal the stench of death inside, but only if I hide. I always know it's lurking underneath. Most days it bubbles right below the surface of what others see as me. They do not know the smell is coming from the one they think they know and understand. The disgusting fragrance that has now become my signature and my brand. It has a name, or so I'm told, that others wear it too. It is costly and paid for by life and not by ounce. It is trauma. You can see, first again, the marinating and the identity of the self is trauma. I am not a person who experienced an event. I am the thing itself. So as a result, again, all of these symptoms appear on your doorstep in the life of someone who has lived this way. So we're going to look more specifically at the characteristics of what we now call complex trauma. I want to give you some broad categories before we do that. And again, keep in mind that when you have a woman on your doorstep with a history of this, you identify her as trafficked. But she is way more than trafficked in terms of the damage that's been done to her. So first of all, just think a minute about child development. A child is malleable. They can be shaped. They are developing a sense of person. You know, who am I? What can I do or not do? What are my skills? Do I matter? Do I have impact? Am I lovable? I have a 2.5-year-old grandson, and he was walking up the stairs in the house backwards, and I said, "You're a crab." I said, "Simon is a crab," and he looks at me. He says, "I'm not a crab." I said, "Okay, what are you?" He said, "I am me." She can't do that. She can't separate me from the trauma. There is no "I am me." So just as children develop knowledge and skills, how to walk or talk or eat or do math, they develop personhood and awareness and sense and assessment of the self as unique, different from others, and full of treasures. The impact of chronic interpersonal violence is staggering. Secondly, complex trauma involves betrayal in core relationships. So it could be parents, grandparents, siblings, teachers, coaches, clergy, whatever. The child is being hurt by someone with power whom they should be able to trust for care and protection. Those who should help not only fail to do so, but repeatedly, either by action or complicity, morally damage the child and erode the sense of self. The self is marinated in abandonment and deceit and humiliation and isolation, and of course, it becomes profoundly twisted. Third, as a result, the child victim develops a deep and abiding sense of shame. Now, we know, we've been around kids, that kids think they're the center of the universe, right? They're egocentric in their thinking. So they easily assume that a bad thing that happened is their fault. It is often reinforced by adults with blaming, shaming words. But in this situation, more than just seeing themselves as doing bad, what they come to believe is that they themselves are the badness. And if they weren't there, there would be no bad. They believe the self is in itself disordered. And of course, as with all shamed human beings, us included, they want to hide. Do the handouts get passed out? Okay.
Thanks, handout team.
There's two. I'm going to go ahead and talk about the one that you don't have in front of you. The first one is simply a list of some of what are known as Erik Erikson stages of development. So, because I just want to briefly look at what a child is supposed to be doing, and this is just one way to configure it. There's certainly other psychologists who have other ways, but this is a helpful one, I think, for what we're looking at today. So, you keep in mind, number one, a fact, which if you've raised adolescents, you would believe this wholeheartedly. The brain in a child is not fully developed until they're 24 years old. You know, so we let them vote, we let them drink, we let them drive, and we let them go to war, but they still aren't finished. So we can say some things about that, but you just have to keep that in mind. So one of the papers is about Erik's stages, and we're going to look at them briefly, but as you look at them, what I would like you to think of is the girl that I described just a little bit ago. This girl, who was a girl instead of a boy, runs away from home at 14 for obvious reasons, because she's escaping sexual and physical violence and all those things and scrounging for food and other people's trash. But her brain, her developing brain and body have been marinated all the time. And now she's hit the streets. She has no safety net, but she wouldn't know what one looked like anyway. And she's picked up by somebody who says, "Call me daddy." Well, she wants daddy. She's wanted daddy since she was born. And so she goes. And you know the stories. You don't need me to tell you those stories. But what I want you to understand is, from the beginning and through adolescence and into her 20s, what is happening? What is she learning? How is she developing? So the first stage that he talks about is from birth to 18 months old. And he lists tasks and what's supposed to occur as a result of that. So you're learning about trust in the first year and a half. You're either learning to trust or you're learning to mistrust. I'm hungry, I cry, mommy feeds me. You know, I try to sit up, I fall over, daddy picks me up. That's how a child learns trust. Something is predictable. Pain, comfort, pain, comfort. And if you learn that properly, you learn to hope. Because even if I hurt, somebody good will come along and help. So this is where children not only develop trust, but optimism, a sense of security, and all of those things. But even at those early stages, if those things never happen, the child is insecure, develops a sense of being a non-entity. I mean, if I fall and I cry and nobody shows up, then nobody sees me. I do not exist. The next one is the toddler, 18 months to 3 years. So this is autonomy versus shame and the use of your will. You get to learn to make choices. So here the child is learning to build self-esteem. You know, you build a tower of blocks and everybody says yay and claps. And they learn how to use new skills during this age. They learn some things about right from wrong. That was nice that you pat your baby brother and didn't sock him in the head. You know, no, you may not put a knife in the electric outlet. That's wrong. That's bad. So we're teaching all the time. The well-cared-for child is sure of himself, learns to carry him or herself with pride during this time. It's the terrible twos. That's where the will shows up. We want them to have a will. We want them to learn how to make good choices with that will. But they don't know what to do with it, so they fall on the floor and have temper tantrums and cry, and they're stubborn, and they do their thing. But that's what they're learning in all of that process. They're very vulnerable during this stage. Feeling shame or bad about the self is very easy to do. So sometimes, and they have a lot of accidents, they knock things over, they do things wrong, they break, I mean, they're two. And so it's very easy for parents in responding to that to do it in shameful ways. They also learn that they are there. You know, you watch somebody build a tower of blocks and everybody's pleased and then they knock it over. What they're learning is, I can make something happen and I can stop something from happening. That's a very important message for all of us to know. Then the preschooler, 3 to 5, initiative and guilt and a sense of purpose. This is when kids start copying mommy and daddy and other people around them. And they're very creative. You know, they're experimenting with a blueprint for what they think it's like to be a grown-up. And so they make up stories with dolls and soldiers and toy phones and cars and all kinds of things. It's like a trial universe. They're trying things out. And it's, you know, that's the wonderful exploring age where every time that you say something, they say, why? They want to know. And so the most important relationship during this stage for the child is the family. That is the cornerstone. That is the foundation for life in the future. It's your safe base for moving out into the world. When it does not happen, the child is full of shame, they retreat, and they call themselves bad. Then the school-aged child, 6 to 12 years, industry versus inferiority and a sense of competence. I mean, they're going to school, they're learning, they take a test, they get a good response, they take a test, they get a bad response. They're learning how to find their own competencies. They're learning to be praised for those competencies, all of those things. And at this stage then, you see the shift. The solid foundation of the family is underneath it all, but now the most important arena is the school and the neighborhood. Parents are, sadly for most of us, no longer the complete authority. We were, but now we're not. And then you get into adolescence, and of course, then you're less of an authority. You're not only not an authority, you're stupid. So, but then you move into adolescence, and that's where they develop a sense of identity and their role in life, and a sense of integrity. So, most of their development prior to adolescence depends on other people and what they do to them. The parents, the babysitter, the Sunday school teacher, the teacher in school. Now, as they move into adolescence, a lot of things depend on what they do and the response they get from their peers. So they have to struggle with their identity and social interactions and all of that thing. You think about the impossibility of these tasks. If all you've been marinated in is trauma, how do you negotiate these things? The self is impaired and twisted. How do you develop a sense of morality if you have never seen morality? You've never been treated morally. The question, who am I? What is my purpose? All the adolescent questions, where do I belong? How do I make choices that have integrity? The questions cannot be answered. They are not even asked. And the last one I have on there, and there's, I mean, he does have us all living beyond 35, which is good because I'm older than that. But that's the last one that I put in here is the young adult, because this is the ages of a lot of the women that you work with. So by this time, they're supposed to be navigating the world, have a sense of competency, know what they're good at, know where they struggle, and they begin to hone in on relationships, and that's where we develop intimacy and solidarity and community. We learn about love, or where we're completely isolated. So that's when people tend to seek out relationship. That's when a lot of people fall, this stage, a lot of people fall in love and get married and have children. Significant relationships with this stage are generally with marital partners and friends and the communities that you connect with, whether it's a church or workplace or whatever. Chronic abuse during development makes a person unable to proceed through these normal phases of growth for human beings. So then, what do we have in close to 100% of trafficked women? Mistrust, no hope. Shame, no sense of ability, capability, or choice. Guilt, no purpose short of survival. That's the goal. Inferiority, no sense of competence, no sense of self or identity. There's no, this is who I choose to be. No integrity of the self, isolated, no real experience of love, and no sense of safety with other human beings. And she's on your door. She has been altered and shaped by chronic, complex trauma, incubated in the mistrust and despair and fear and worthlessness and aloneness and shame of that trauma. and they have become woven into herself. It's not a self with a feeling. It is who she is. They have shaped her I am. They're not just feelings or thoughts. They are her. So let's look more specifically then at some of the things that occur when a person lives through complex trauma and what's changed. Oh boy. What's changed in there? Is it okay? Okay. One of the things that is not regulated is affect and impulse. You know that. People with prolonged trauma overreact to stress, become easily overwhelmed, or for many of them, it's just the status quo. It's not like I feel overwhelmed and then I don't. I just am overwhelmed. They don't even know there's another way to be. They exhibit often intense anger. They have difficulty calming themselves, and they are often very self-destructive. They find it difficult to modulate and manage feelings and impulses. So impulses of suicide, sexual acting out, risk-taking behavior are not managed. And usually, the self-modulating that they do is harmful. I modulate my feelings and impulses through addictions, through self-harm, through other coping mechanisms. And the things, which was, I think, said yesterday, the things that we look at as problems are solutions. And not only that, some of them, as bad as they are life-saving solutions. Because if I get smashed out of my mind on alcohol, I won't kill myself tonight. So you see the use of something that's damaging to protect. Second, we see changes in attention and consciousness in people who have lived like this. The trauma was inescapable. It's very distressing. It overwhelms the coping mechanisms. So when we're overwhelmed and there's no escape, then there's a huge relationship between trauma and dissociation. There have been several studies that say that dissociative experiences at the moment of trauma is the most significant long-term predictor for the development of a trauma disorder. Because what it means is, it was so bad, I left. Victims who suffer interpersonal abuse prior to age 14 develop significantly more dissociative symptoms, which could be flashbacks, it could be nightmares, it could be lots of things. But when that happens, the information of their lives is never integrated into their minds. And traumatic experiences then are over here somewhere because I can't face them. It cannot be effectively cataloged in the brain. You can't label it. You can't understand it. So I would assume with most of you in the room, if I said to you, tell me something sad that happened to you in your life, you would go in your brain and pull out the file labeled sad, and you would open it up and you would pick something. Well, they can't do that. The file is over there somewhere with those things I don't want to think about. So they can't even talk to you about it initially. There's no capacity in the brain of a child to make those files. If, like my case, their whole life is nothing but abuse, what file do you put that in? There is no file in a child's mind. So you think about it, you're a five-year-old girl, and you live in a house where you're chronically neglected, beaten, and raped. And in addition, there's constant gun violence in the neighborhood, and your parents are drug addicts. How is a child's mind supposed to absorb those experiences, those memories, even the smells and the pain and the cognitive twisting and emotions and all of those things? If the child tried to hold all those things the way we do in normal situations, they would go stark, raving, mad. Let me read you a little poem again. This is on deception. And part of what it helps us see is that deception is a coping mechanism. It's very difficult for us to grasp that. Oh, little mind of mine, running around in circles, trying to decide where it's safe and where you can rest. Little mind of mine, exploring your options, tempted to play hide and seek from yourself to deny, shroud, cover, conceal what you know. Sitting together with shards of memory and present blades of truth, will you choose to leave or will you stay? Will you choose to be present to your life, as the tall one in the corner office has called you to? The message of truth she's delivered from him, or will you continue to inject yourself with deception? Deception is a drug. It makes bad things go away. There's a fascinating book called Holocaust Testimonies, The Ruins of Memory. It was written by a man named Lawrence Langer in 1991. And when I started out working with trauma and there was no word or category for trauma, I didn't know how to think about it. And I, long story short, ended up reading tons of things about the Nazi Holocaust. That's where I first learned about trauma. So this is a book that I read some years ago. But he's studying the memories of those who survived the Nazi Holocaust. Now, keep in mind, though, many of these were adults in that experience, but some of them were children. And so they had these childhood experiences where they marinated in the trauma. But he talks about the fact that the memory doesn't get integrated. And so it's all split up and hidden in the mind. And he says that memory functions, continues on with or without speech. So what that basically means is you're working with women who have all of these memories and experiences of trauma in their minds, and they are living out of them, even though they couldn't tell you about them if they tried. But they still are controlling them. Memory, he says, cannot be silenced in the mind. So if that's so, we might as well figure out how to listen to it. But the point is that whether memory is spoken internally or externally, it continues to impact and shape a life. It often speaks through symptoms, not words. And sometimes it speaks through symptoms and not words because the person who's acting the stuff out doesn't even recall the memory of what led to that. When I was in graduate school in Philadelphia, and I was at that point reading about the Holocaust, some of us students went to a fellow student's home in the evening one night, and we were sitting around in the living room, and his mother was there. And she was from a European country, I don't remember which one. She was talking to us, and she made tea and all that kind of stuff, and a siren went off because a police car went by. And she got up, she looked like this, and ran into a closet and shut the door and started screaming. I had no idea what I was looking at. That was the first time I ever saw a flashback. But her son said she can't talk about it. But her symptoms talk about it. She's telling her story. When she hears a siren, she has a siren story, or 12. She's telling the story by going in the closet and screaming. Langer uses the term anguished memory. He has many different types. This is only one, which is the memory that finally assaults and divides the self. So Holocaust survivors, if you talk to them, talk about the inability to put the past and the present together. So one says, I split myself. It wasn't me there. It just wasn't me. It was somebody else. Or another one, my head is filled with garbage. All these images and sounds and smells, you can't cut it out. It's like another skin beneath my skin, and you can't shed it. I am not like you. You have one vision of life. I have two. I live a double life. Or there's sort of a division, you know, compartmentalizing what happened, and it's very separate, but it isn't. It must not interfere. It must not become so overwhelming that it will make normal life unable to function. I live a double existence. The double of Auschwitz does not mingle with my present life. It's as if it were not me at all. The third category for complex trauma is its destruction of self-perception, which of course means the sense of self is simply something that is flawed. I am undesirable, unlovable, I am helpless, I am powerless. Those were all part of Erikson's stages. Victims blame themselves for the abuse and believe they cannot be understood by others. I couldn't count how many people said to me, you're not going to believe it if I tell you. Or they minimize it and make it small so it seems believable. They carry a great sense of shame, not just about what was done to them, but they think it says who they are. But they also have shame regarding their current symptoms. So oftentimes you'll get somebody who's really tough or whatever, and you'll ask her how she is, and she says, I'm fine. When in fact, they don't really even know what fine feels like. But so rather than seeing the self as someone worthy of love and esteem and created by God, it's seen as nothing, worthless, actively evil, and you best keep it hidden. Fourth has to do with the way they think about their perpetrators. Many victims are constantly thinking about their abuser. They are fearful he will reappear. They have sometimes really good reasons to be afraid of that, right? Sometimes you're fearful they will reappear. Or they're planning revenge. Or they're feeling and living still controlled by him, even if he's been dead for 20 years. They attribute great and total power to the abuser. And I find sometimes with therapists, and I would imagine it would be true with you sometimes, you want to downplay that. It can't be that bad. You're safe. Well, she might not be. So you have to figure out how to work with that in the reality of the situation, because in fact, it could still be a threatening situation. Because as you know, there are very evil and very powerful people. Powerful people out there, and fear of them is not a stupid idea. We just want them to feel safe. They need to feel safe with us and in our place, but we have to also deal with the reality of the situation. And a second way I sometimes think of perpetrators is that when they've had a history, long history of child abuse, the child, by necessity, bonds with a perpetrator. Because they depend on this perpetrator for their very existence. You know, I talked about this woman being chained to the radiator and having to eat dog food next to the dog. Well, she could have said no, but she would have starved to death. So there's a bond there. This is the man who feeds me. If I don't eat, I'll die. Children often cope with what we call doublethink. Judith Herman talks about this in her classic book, Trauma and Recovery, which if you haven't read it, you should. But it goes like this. I know the perpetrator does bad things, but I choose to believe that I am bad and made him do those things. Therefore, the perpetrator is really good and I can depend on the perpetrator to take care of me and feed me. And if I can just figure out how to be good, I can make all this stop. So that's how the child gets a little bit of trust and a little bit of hope. It's all false, but that's how they survive. And then, of course, as you know, victims can often be very bonded to the perpetrator. I mean, daddy? That also happens in incest situations where the mother is silent and complicit. The father sexually abuses the daughter, but he's also the one who makes sure she has clean clothes for school, makes sure she gets dinner and does her homework. So he's the kindest person in the house. He just happens to have sex with her 3 times a week. Well, you can see the utter confusion for a child mind trying to navigate all of this. Fifth, distortions in relationships. So obviously, repeated and premeditated abuse result in all kinds of attachment disorders. If somebody is chronically mistreated, it leads to recurring victimization, inability to trust. Sometimes they victimize others. Intimacy is not possible. They can't feel it because if you get too close, you get scared. You can't be intimate if you're scared. There's no model in their minds or their history for healthy relationships. And they cannot make good and wise choices about who is safe and who is not. You cannot do what you cannot imagine. And sometimes what they learn, because they dissociate when something bad is happening, is I walk down a dark alley, I hear footsteps, I get on high alert. She walks down an alley, she hears footsteps, she dissociates, she gets raped. That happens all the time to people with victim histories. Sometimes they see the warning signs and they feel helpless to deal with them because they were. And so they just give in. So these kinds of things will profoundly impact the relationship that you have with them. You want them to trust you, to be good, to be safe, to have their best interest, all of that stuff. They don't even know what you're talking about. And some of them will fight trusting you with as much rage as they can because they're scared to death that if they're vulnerable, they're going to get crushed again. And some of them will pretend to trust you and then pull the rug out from under you later.